This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in Religion. I'm your host, Amarnath Amarasingham. What is the role of religion in the military? What are the roles of religious chaplains in the military? How are important issues such as post-traumatic stress, religious and ethnic diversity, and related concerns dealt with in the Canadian Forces? Joanne Benham-Renick's groundbreaking book, Religion in the Ranks, Belief and Religious Experience in the Canadian Forces, approaches these issues head-on. Based on extensive interviews with chaplains and with personnel of various religious and spiritual backgrounds, the book provides much-needed insight into the religious lives of military personnel. How do soldiers who have endured difficult assignments, witnessed atrocities, and perhaps experienced feelings of ongoing isolation cope? How important is religion and spirituality in this coping process? How are all these questions further complicated by the increasing ethnic, cultural, and religious diversity of the military personnel themselves? We talked to Joanne about these and related matters, such as the difficulties involved in obtaining access to do research on the military in the first place, and some of the challenges faced by military personnel after they return home.
So thanks for joining us, Joanne. I hope you're having a good morning.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's a very interesting book, but before we get into that, I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about yourself and where you went to school and how you first became interested in religion.
My background is sociology of religion. I did the PhD program in religion in North America through Laurier and Waterloo. I was a Waterloo student. I came to this particular topic for this book just because I had been following the situation as it developed in Rwanda during the genocide there. And one of the things that struck me very poignantly was when Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, who had led that cohort of soldiers there in the task force in Rwanda, when he returned and when he spoke about his experience, he used very religious language, which was considerably unusual coming from someone who was a leading general in a very secular, very public institution. He was using very traditional language to describe what he had experienced and what he had seen. He was using very traditional Christian language. So for me, that kind of was reminiscent of that old expression that there are no atheists in foxholes, because General Dallaire was not someone who would have described himself as particularly religious. And yet when he faced this horrific context of people being butchered and slaughtered in the street, he fell back on this kind of language. There was no other way for him to describe what he'd seen. So that was sort of the starting point for me in terms of investigating what does religion look like, how does it act, what role does it play in a putatively secular institution that is representative of Canada on multiple fronts, not just at home, but abroad, and doing many different things abroad, humanitarian aid or disaster relief or conflict, peacekeeping, a whole raft of things. What role does religion play, if any? So that was kind of my starting point for the book, and that's kind of where I come at it from.
So his statement that stood out to you was from the late 90s or so?
Yeah, so he was talking about, you've probably heard of the film that was made, Shake Hands with the Devil, and he talked about having experienced pure evil, that at the darkest moments there, he actually felt that there was almost a physical force of evil. And then he also had a different experience of some sense of peace, some sense of hope, and he felt that it was almost a transcendent experience, and he couldn't explain that, and he didn't try to explain that. He just said, that's how it was. Like, it was this for us. And we were in the deepest pit of despair, thinking that it was all over, and there was almost this sense of transcendent something with us. So he was, labeling his personal experience, but he also talked about the carnage that was happening and the pitting of neighbor against neighbor. He talked about that in religious language. He talked about that as pure evil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I read his book, Shake Hands with the Devil, a while ago, and it still kind of haunts me sometimes.
It is. It's a very disturbing book. Yeah. It's the kind of, it almost takes a piece out of you when you read it. You just think, woo. Yeah. So, and that really comes across when you speak to him. And when I spoke to him, he elucidated that it just essentially, it did take a piece of him. And his experiences after that conflict, I think, show that very poignantly, because like so many people who have faced trauma, he was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, and he had issues with, drug and alcohol abuse, and just not able to cope with the mundane life that he returned to after seeing such horrific things. And interestingly, again, one of the things he described was that he found a lot of solace. Not being a religious person, he actually did find solace in religious spaces. And that wasn't true for all of the veterans of that experience, because a lot of people were very, very aggressively angry at religion, because religion was a very significant part of that conflict. And in fact, religious leaders were involved in that conflict and in inciting violence. So it was a very confusing kind of situation for people who were religious. But in his case, he described being able to walk into places of worship and to just sit in the peace and the silence and find a sense of sanctuary there. And I thought that was kind of interesting too, because he said that wasn't really his way prior to that experience, but somehow that had resonance for him after the fact.
You mean while he was in Rwanda, he found
after.
Oh, after he came here,
being treated for post-traumatic stress disorder, even before that, that he was able to go and just sit in the silence of a place of worship. Didn't matter which, like, just that he could go sit in it and feel a sense of sanctuary there in the silence, in the darkness, in the quiet. And that was meaningful for him.
In terms of the academic context, is the literature on religion in the military, or religion and the military, fairly large or not?
Oh,
really?
Oh my goodness, it's virtually non-existent. That is really challenging. And even in the last couple of years, I've had a number of people from the States and Canada that are kind of interested in doing some work in this area, and they're asking me to guide them to some of the literature, and I'm literally saying to them, well, best of luck, because there really isn't very much on this topic. There's a fair bit of material linked to the chaplains and chaplaincy. There's a little bit of material linked to diversity, but there's really nothing that takes a sociological examination of the connecting points between those issues. So whether you're a believer or whether you're a practitioner and whether you're a member, and the place that religion, the way that religion ties or links those various identities together, there hasn't been very much done at all. Just recently, a colleague of mine in the States published a book. Again, it follows many of the same themes as mine, but it looks very specifically at chaplaincy. There's a real shortage, so it would be a great area for people that are looking for fields to examine. There's lots of room to do more work there.
How do you explain the lack of research? Or is it just kind of the church and state issue, or is it issue of access, or is it something
else? Definitely, I would say it's both of those for sure. Because you know, to some degree, the military doesn't really necessarily want to know, or doesn't want to. It has bigger issues that it does want to address, and I think that. Especially right now, I mean, the focus is on what can we cut. And, you know, for the last few decades, except for a few blips there, it's really been on what can we cut. So there's a disinclination to looking at areas that need special funding or special resources or that kind of thing. But on the flip side, there are many, many good people that are concerned with issues of social justice and access in the military. And there's also a military mandate to serve the whole person. So they have to supply the resources that people need. That includes basic things like, you know, food and housing, but also socio-emotional, spiritual supports. So it's tightly controlled from the military's point of view. It's a very challenging area to start talking about, and they're concerned about who's doing it, how they're doing it, what they're doing it for. And as a civilian trying to work with that, within that context, that also is going to require anybody who approaches it to have a certain level of tenacity and determination, because it's a very challenging context to get your foot in the door. The other point that you mentioned, though, was an issue.
Access.
Yeah, the access. And access to finding the right people, the key people, and people moving all over the country all the time. You know, so that was a challenge for me. I'd make a contact and they would say, yeah, okay, that's great, we'll meet. And then I would get a phone call or an email saying, actually, I've been moved to Cold Lake, or I've been, you know, and be like, wow, okay, that's not going to work out. So, or, you know, or most of the, minority groups, when I was trying to contact people that, you know, belong to a group that represented a very small minority within the forces, a lot of those people belong in the reserves, or sorry, they don't belong in the reserves, they're in the reserves, and they're linked to the larger cities around Canada, and they were often hard to connect with just because they were either being deployed often, or they kind of didn't know where they'd be, or they had full-time jobs, or they were kind of, you know, moving around doing other things with their lives. So it's challenging to, if you're trying to conduct interviews with people, it's difficult to find them. And it's not like you can just walk in and say, ah, great, I've got my focus group, they're right here, they're going to stay here. They're all over the place.
Right. I mean, in terms of when you mentioned tightly controlled, were there any bureaucratic impediments to getting access to the military? What is the permissions that you need to get?
Yeah, you have to go through a fair number of hoops, actually, to do that. You've got to, in addition to your own institution's ethics approval, you've got to get approval from a board within the military, and you need to also have an endorsing agency, so you need to get sponsorship, essentially, is what it's called. So some body within the military has to essentially identify your research project as relevant and essential to military objectives. And once you have that, then you can approach their ethics board and have them review what you're proposing, have them revise it, have them you know, identify any concerns or issues and put their qualifiers on it. And with respect to my work, that included things like, you know, there was a sensitivity to the fact that we have a very small force in Canada, and that at the time that I was doing my research, people had been on multiple rotations, and they were very tired, and they were worn down. And there had also been numbers of studies where one of the research review members said to me, you know, our people, they've been poked and prodded and interviewed and harassed, and we really don't want any additional research going on them than is absolutely necessary. So they were very sensitive to the fact that, you know, these are human beings, these are not guinea pigs, we can't just use them over and over again, and we want to make sure that what you're doing here is something that will, in the long run, benefit these people.
Uh-huh. So I imagine the ethics approval even at the university and at the military in terms of that question they ask about trauma and, you know, are you going to force people to relive their experiences? Was that a kind of long-term process in terms of getting that approval?
Yeah, that was very arduous. There were so many things about that project that involved tenacity and perseverance and patience because, there were a lot of concerns around that. And for obvious reasons, you know, people have been through really devastating experiences. The last thing you want is somebody coming along and picking out a scab just because they want to get their, you know, their PhD and get out the door onto their own life. So obviously that is a big concern. And, you know, both my ethics review board and the military review board were saying, you know, how are you going to handle this? You have to have these parameters in place. We want to guarantee that people will know what their options are and that people will not be pushed to tell stories that they're not comfortable telling you and that they shouldn't be asked to speak to you if they are not volunteering of their, you know, their own interest and their own purposes. And obviously that was what I wanted too. You don't want to destroy somebody in the process.
So who were you able to interview in terms of methodology and were they willing to talk for the most part or was there difficulty?
Where I really got lucky was I made some excellent contacts within the chaplain branch, and the chaplains were obviously people who are interested in knowing the state of religion within the forces. And because that is not data that is compiled and, you know, analyzed, it's gathered because everybody needs to have it stamped on their dog tags and in their personal record, and people need to know it in case there's an incident and they want a religious leader to support them. It's not the kind of information that is statistically compiled and analyzed. So the chaplains themselves were very interested in the project, and they were interested in hearing what members were saying about religion, whether it was kind of do they consider this a relic? Do they consider it a nuisance? Is it valuable to them? If so, in what ways? And so those guys and women were the door that opened for me and really gave me my first toehold into the military context. And they were superbly generous with their own time and also with helping me to locate units and commanders that would be able to say, well, I think, you know, we could probably put this out here and ask people if they're interested and they can contact you. And that was really great. So that was how I found people. And then once I found a few individuals, often they would be talking to me and they'd be saying, you know, I had this conversation with you might want to talk to, and then they'd give me another name. And so it was that snowball effect, you know, that I found one and then I found another and then I found 10 more. And in some cases, I really had to hunt people down because they were just weren't that many of them, you know, or else wherever they were, again, they'd just been shipped out or they had not stayed in the region wherever I was long enough for me to be able to actually have a real conversation with them. So there were some cases where it was a matter of, there's a great blog that's done. It's called CF Sikh, and it's a group of Sikh reservists, and they write about their various experiences in the forces, and that was great. You know, I tried to connect with those guys about five different times, and they somebody in that group was always out of the country. They were being shipped out. They were on maneuvers. They were in training. And so in the end, most of the work that I did with those guys was based on their already published material on their website and on their blog. But, you know, you kind of have to make do when there is no literature in the field. You kind of, you have to dig up based on what's available, right? So it was an interesting experience. That's for sure.
right away in the introduction of the book, you talk about you know, what sociologists call the late modern approach to religion. I wonder if you can elaborate on what you mean by that and how that proved to be important in studying.
Yeah, I think that's maybe one of the most interesting aspects of studying religion today is just that it's not one thing. If it ever really was one thing, it certainly isn't today. But, you know, people have this notion, when you say the word religion, people have this notion of, oh, yeah, I know what that is. But when you start to talk to a group of people about what religion is, it immediately becomes clear that everybody in the group has a different idea of what religion is. And so when we talk about the late modern approach to religion, we're really talking about a subjectivized and individualized approach to religious belief or religious thinking or religious practice. And that's where the waters get really muddy. So we can't just take, you know, the dictionary definition of, you know, say a Hindu and say, well, this is what a Hindu is and this is what a Hindu does. This is how a Hindu acts. This is what a Hindu eats. You can't do that because inevitably you'll find someone who doesn't do any of those things or does only a third of those things or does a few of those things, but also does several of the things that the Buddhist is doing and that the Muslim is doing. And so you suddenly have an individual who's a composite of all these different traditions and then maybe has thrown in a few of their own sort of, well, my granny used to do that. It has nothing to do with religion, I don't think, but I just like it. So you've got a very strange bricolage of different approaches to expressing and engaging with that which is, I suppose, the transcendence, that which is beyond us, that we can't understand, that we think of when we think about the big questions, the big issues of life. And so it becomes much more of a spiritual kind of framework or language, which of course scholars of religion, they just hate that even more than trying to nail down the definition of religion. You start using the word spiritual and people just start rubbing their temples and going, oh, I don't know. But on the other hand, it makes for some very, very interesting conversations with people. When you start to engage with them in a way that moves them beyond that, you know, notion of orthodox religion, people really are interested and they're really engaged with those topics. And I had some of my most interesting interviews were with people that were absolutely not religious and would emphatically state, I'm not religious. I don't care about religion. I don't approve of it. I'm an atheist or I'm an agnostic or I don't go or blah, blah, blah. But they would say just the most wonderfully insightful things about their own sense of their spiritual nature and their way of engaging beyond the physical and the absolute and the obvious. And that was really neat. So that was an interesting aspect of that late modern context of religion.
You go on to provide a kind of historical sketch of the chaplaincy in the Canadian military, and I was wondering, I mean, without going into details that are probably outside the focus of the podcast, but what surprised you most about the historical shifts that happened in the Canadian military?
Well, it's interesting to think about, you know, people, the chaplaincy really initially developed because, well, for a number of reasons, but one of the interesting things was that religious leaders volunteered to go and participate in World War I and World War II simply in order to provide support to Canadian men that had enlisted. And they acted as soldiers, but they also acted as the camp scouts, if you want to say it that way. Like they were people that would help people interpret letters that, you know, people that were illiterate and couldn't write a letter home to their loved ones. It would be the educated chaplain that was sitting in the camp with them, or they would help. They would do things like manage the camp meals for them. And they'd facilitate and they'd boost morale and they'd do things like that. And it was after the Second World War where there was recognition that they actually were providing a very beneficial and important role, making a significant contribution. And so that was kind of interesting. It was a voluntary effort by people who believed that that the people in the field really, they needed something, some kind of support that was beyond just leadership or morale boosting. It was actually a spiritual kind of support, and as a result that became an embedded institution within the Canadian Forces itself.
Mm-hmm. There's a interesting term that you use later on in the book where you talk about how Western or how people have described the Western military after the collapse of the Soviet Union in terms of the postmodern military. Mm-hmm. Is that just a Canadian thing, or is that how?
No, that's used widely in the military
What is meant by that term?
It's that a military force is no longer simply just a force for combat, and that it engages multiple groups for multiple purposes, and that it can incorporate civilian roles, and that it might be doing humanitarian roles, and it might be doing all kinds of roles at the same time on the same mission. That it might, so many of our task force situations now are involve a Canadian unit going in and then working with, you know, four or five different nations units on a shared project. So, for example, you know, with the earthquake in Haiti, we have forces going in from different countries to provide humanitarian aid and reconstruction, and also to provide policing. So they're doing multiple activities at the same time. They're from a number of different nations, and they're working together for a shared mission. So that's a different kind of military focus than we've seen, you know, in times past, where it's really we have an enemy and we're going in to destroy the enemy, and that's what we do as a military force. So it's a change dynamic there.
And has there been a I would imagine if the military is involved in civilian roles, there's a kind of backlash from the population sometimes, and has that had an effect on morale and things like that?
Oh, frequently that's an issue. So there's a whole genre of literature in military sociology that talks about civil-military relations. And you know, with the whole Iraq and Afghanistan situation, there was the motto was winning hearts and minds, right? So it was the idea that we were trying to engage people, trying to get civilians and locals to understand us as not the bad guy, not the warrior, not the neo-colonial, but somebody who's here because we're concerned for the welfare, and we want to work together with them, we want to collaborate, and we want to change this situation. So definitely there has been a lot of attention paid to that. I think also other conflicts we could look at, you know, in Bosnia, for example, it was very difficult to be placed in a role that was supposedly a peacekeeping role or an observer role, and then see atrocities happening and not be allowed to intervene. And a number of the people I interviewed talked about that as one of the most stressful aspects of their work, that they'd be places, they'd see horrible things happening, and they were not allowed to stop them because that was not their defined role for that mission. So I think the civil-military link is a really poignant one, and one that, again, would really benefit from more investigation and more discussion, more analysis.
Mm-hmm. What has been the religious makeup of the Canadian forces for, I guess, this historical sketch that you talk about? And when did that start to change along with, you know, the shifts in immigration and broader Canadian society? Or is that has it been separate from mainstream shifts?
Well, it largely follows and has followed the Canadian religious demographic. So you have largest majority from a Christian background. How much they're actually involved with their tradition is hard to say, because people who enlist in the military tend to be still young men who, if we can trust the census data, are the least religiously inclined group to begin with. But they come from families and communities that have largely identified themselves as Christian, majority of those Catholic, and then, you know, a subset of those that you can see the tables in the book, but the breakdown includes all kinds of different Protestant denominations. And then we have very small pockets of non-Christian groups. And to some degree, you know, Muslims and Jewish groups have been present, less so other traditions until more recently. But during World War II, for sure, there were Jewish people involved in both wars. There were definitely documentation of Jewish participation. And then more recently, we're seeing, as the demographic in Canada changes, we're definitely seeing a larger influx of groups that have not historically been identified in the Canadian military. So Hindus, Sikhs, Buddhists, other groups like that, always a large contingent of Aboriginals, but the Aboriginals often are also Christian rather than Aboriginal spirituality. So they tend to, if we're talking about religion exclusively, they tend to be subsumed under that heading rather than Aboriginal spirituality.
Why is that?
Oh, because largely in Canada, Aboriginals are Christians.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of how these minority religious groups have been coping, what has been some of the challenges they've experienced, or has there been general accommodation?
Well, I think this was an issue along the lines of, you know, in the States it was the "don't ask, don't tell" policy towards homosexuals, and then, you know, we had in Canada the integration of women was a big ordeal because it was, you know, this is a hassle. This changes the way we do things. This decreases efficiency. So I think, similar to those challenges, the integration of minorities has both been a necessary evolution and also fraught with resistance from those who see it as taking away their traditions and their own culture. So you've got groups that are saying, no, we don't want minorities in here. We don't want people that don't look like us and act like us and talk like us and dress like us and eat like us. And then there are others saying, well, that's absurd. You know, this is who we are as Canadians. So I think that the people that I spoke to, minority groups that I spoke to and individuals said that by and large they were treated well, but mostly what they faced was a lack of understanding. And it wasn't malicious misunderstanding. It was just that, you know, I'm not a religious person, so I have no idea why you are doing this. Like, I don't understand why you're wearing that, or I don't understand why you have to get different rations while we're out in the field, or I don't understand why you get time off to do, you know, prayer or whatever it is that you are doing that you claim to be a religious thing, because I'm not religious, so I don't get it. I don't understand it. So that, I think, would be the biggest hindrance that people have faced. Other groups have said that they found people very, very generous and tolerant, but self-conscious about asking. So feeling guilty almost that they didn't understand, and they would argue that, you know, if there could be more opportunities for discussion and more opportunities to just sit down and talk about those differences, then it would be easier to relate and understand and then move forward as a cohesive unit.
Right. In terms of the atheists, I mean, has there been a similar, I mean, there's a lot of literature in terms of sociology where atheists are feel discriminated against, and there is some evidence that they are discriminated against. Has that replicated itself in the military, or?
Well, to the extent, I don't think anybody in the military is pushing religion. I shouldn't say nobody is, but by and large, I don't think that's the goal. And the chaplains, for sure, are very sensitive to the notion of not proselytizing. That they don't understand their role as being there to convert people or evangelize or win them to whatever faith tradition they represent. But I think it has definitely been a sense of the military culture has long involved religious rituals that don't necessarily come simply from the chaplaincy, but are a lingering aspect of Canadian Christian society. So it has been normal, historically speaking, for parades or remembrance events and things like that to include prayers. And so what's happened now is that there are multi-faith representation, but those who have said, well, I'm not interested in any faith representation, they may make that argument that, yeah, this is not acceptable to me because I don't believe in any of these things. On the flip side, I think there has been more attention being paid to recognizing that rejection of and discomfort with orthodox frameworks for religion. And that's not to say an atheist doesn't have any spiritual beliefs. It's often a matter of resentment towards or anger at traditional religion and things associated with traditional religion. So I think that's going to be anywhere, really, where people who have a shared kind of understanding of a process or an event, so a memorial event, for example, they have a shared notion of, well, this is how it's always been done, and this is what's appropriate. I think that's going to be there with folks that come at it from a vantage point of, well, that's not my way and that's not my focus. And I think that, again, also just requires ongoing conversation and dialogue and opportunities to create different ways of, say, honoring the dead, or, you know, whatever the process is. But I think there has to be an awareness of those concerns before they can be addressed or changed. And again, because the literature is so sparse, I don't think that awareness is there yet. So it's just sort of that undercurrent of frustration and anxiety.
And has that been experienced by, you know, you have an interesting section on, or a short section on new religions also, in terms of pagans who find themselves in the military, or how have they, in other words, you know, when we think of diversity, we think of Muslims, Jews, Hindus, and Sikhs and so on, but then what happens to these kind of very small new religious movements?
Yeah,
and how
the pagan groups were interesting, because that was something that kind of surprised me. There's actually a fairly large contingent, or appears to be anyway. Again, there's no statistics, so I can't validate that, but there appears to be a fairly large contingent of active pagans in the Canadian forces, and I'm not sure why that is. Different people suggested different reasons behind it. One of them was that it's often very feminist way of believing, and so a lot of women in the forces have embraced paganism as an expression of their own, you know, spiritual or religious interests. But it seems to me that it was broader than that, and there are a lot of websites and discussion groups and blogs dedicated to pagans and Wiccans in the Canadian forces. And the it often falls to the chaplain, because the chaplain's role is to accommodate religious needs. It often falls to the chaplain, whatever tradition they are from, to accommodate the needs of any member of the unit that they serve. So if you have, say, an evangelical Christian chaplain, and you have a Wiccan in that unit that comes to them and says, well, I want to do this, I want to, you know, celebrate the summer solstice, then the chaplain has to accommodate that religious need, or to the extent that it's appropriate and that they can, meaning they have to, you know, always be concerned for the welfare of the broader community and the individuals involved and those kinds of things. But to the extent that they can accommodate it, they're required to. So they, I think, have tried to do that, and there are numbers of examples, and, you know, in the book, and also if you review some of the media reports about people in the field, ways in which they have been supported in their efforts to express this or practice this religious tradition. And it's quite interesting that, you know, again, I think that's a very paradoxical and unusual kind of aspect of religion in the military, that you've got this sort of nature and holistic and old-timey religion, yeah. and it's linked up with this hard, institutionalized military context. It's a strange and interesting link there.
So according to your research, you're saying that you suspect, anyway, even without quantitative data, that there's a higher proportion of new religions, or pagans at least, in the Canadian forces than in mainstream Canadian society, or is it kind of reflective?
Yeah, I honestly couldn't compare it, because those numbers would be a guess, but I was just really surprised to find as much interest in it, both from people I met and interviewed, people who knew people. People would, you know, mm-hmm. frequently, oh yeah, I know somebody that, oh yeah, I know this person, and it often came up in conversation, and then that there's a lot of stuff on the internet. Pagans and Wiccan groups tend to be very comfortable in the internet kind of environment, so that may just be a reflection of that style of religion, or it may be that there are actually more of them there. I couldn't say, you know, which it is, but it certainly would be another interesting avenue for research for somebody that's inclined to go that way.
Mm-hmm. One of my more favorite chapters, I guess, is chapter 3, where you talk about some of the personal challenges of the chaplaincy. And can you describe some of these challenges and what stood out to you most, I guess, when writing, in terms of some of the personal challenges and personality shifts that people are going through?
For the chaplains themselves, you mean?
Yeah.
The chaplains are an interesting group of people. These are people who they represent an orthodox context, and yet they work in a heterodox context. You know, so they've been trained to be ministers or leaders of whatever their faith tradition is, and they have been assigned to a role that belongs to their institutional model, and then they're put in a context where their number one priority is to serve the military institution's needs. And so they're often pitted between their vocational calling and their institutional mandate, and then trying to walk that line of how to serve both sides of that, and how to meet the needs of the individuals that they enlisted to support, and also to ensure that they are fulfilling the obligations of their military mandate. That, I think, was probably a significant area for discussion for the full time that I was conducting the research. And that came from every level within the chaplaincy. People would talk about this. Yes, we know it's a challenge. It's there, but we try to negotiate it. And people would talk about different ways that they negotiated it, or that in theory that it could have been negotiated. But when you heard stories from individuals, it was often a very complicated and very difficult task for many, many people. And so one example would be with the situation with gay marriage. There were many people in the military that might choose to have a wedding ceremony and be married in a religious wedding. But only United Church ministers at the time were able to validate that kind of a wedding. So if you have an evangelical minister who is in the first place against homosexuality, in the second place not allowed by his denomination or her denomination to officiate over a gay marriage, you have this dual challenge where they, you know, people, you have to serve the military person's, the member's need, their interest, their religious desire to have this right practice, but you also have to reject them and say, well, I can't do it for you, or I don't want to do it for you, or I think what you're doing is wrong. So there's this kind of continual negotiation that has to occur, both for the chaplain themselves and in relation to these other two governing bodies that they are responding to, and also to the people that they are purported to be serving.
So you mean institutionally there are, you know, the rights and freedoms that they have to uphold, but then religiously they may be against some
exactly.
of those.
Yeah, so I mean, even, and that's not just the chaplains, that's also believers. So I interviewed one person who was a very traditional evangelical, and his issue, one of his issues was that women had no place in the military. So it wasn't even there are broader issues that different faith traditions come in conflict with one another, but he was saying, no, the military is a man's environment, it's a man's world, there's no place for women here. Really, he said to me, really, women belong in, you know, barefoot and in the kitchen. That's really where they belong. And I was thinking, wow. And I said to him, that must be incredibly challenging for you to work in this environment with this integrated kind of situation where you're working with women and men, you're working with people of different faith traditions. And he says, yes, it is. he felt that he was being discriminated against to have to, you know, to
right.
exist in this kind of mixed world.
I don't know how much you're familiar with the American situation, but are there any parallels in terms of these similar struggles going on with the U.S. military and the Canadian military?
Yeah, I think virtually everything, that all of the themes that come up in my book are are in evidence in the American system as well, except that probably they have more diversity, simply because they're a much, much larger force. They, as I mentioned, there is a new book by one of my colleagues in the States, and it echoes so much of what I identified. But rather than looking at the individual experiences, it deals exclusively with the chaplaincy. But still, the frames, the frameworks are very closely aligned to, you know, issues related to diversity, changing tasks, trying to provide support for people that don't fit into an orthodox framework anymore, all of those kinds of issues. And then, you know, human rights issues linked to religious expression, religious diversity, and also other kinds of diversity, right? So women's rights and gay rights and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this may not be so much of a religious question, but did anything come out in your interviews in terms of how the Canadian how people felt the Canadian public viewed the military, or how the international community viewed the Canadian forces? Because, you know, there's a lot of, sometimes people make a lot of fun of the Canadian military, right? So did that come out in any of the comments?
Yeah, at different times and in different ways it did. You know, there's that whole national myth of Canada being a country of peacekeepers, right? That one always comes up. And I think that was a point of frustration to a lot of people that I met, not because they weren't proud of being peacekeepers. They were, but they were arguing that it's much more complicated than that, and that they're not just trained to be blue helmets. They're trained to do all kinds of things. So people would tell me stories about, you know, being bivouacked in a field that week by week would get, you know, rained on, like 9 inches at a time. And they would, by the time they were done, that the platforms that they had built to sleep on were actually right on the surface of the water. And it was just miserable, and it was cold, and there was all kinds of illness, and there were infections, and there was mosquitoes and bugs, and that was simply an observation role. So they weren't doing anything. And so they were frustrated by the fact that, you know, this is the kind of task that sometimes they're given, and people don't fully understand that it's not just that, well, we go to fight wars, or we go to stop wars, or we do all kinds of different things. Like, we're the people that are burying bodies when there's hundreds of people dying from cholera, and we're the people that are, you know, digging holes for context where something's been blown up, and we're the people that are doing this really grungy, dirty work, and we're the people that are getting shot at, you know. So I think it was frustration to some degree that they really are misunderstood by the Canadian population. But I think in Canada too, I think we are still at that place where we're trying to, on the one hand, differentiate ourselves from the Americans, and on the other hand, align ourselves with the economic context that is linked to an American global structure. So it's a challenging place to be as the neighbors to the most powerful country in the world, deciding which priorities we will set for ourselves and how that will look in our military role.
Mm-hmm. I guess when I first think of the religion of the military, the what comes to mind is this issue of post-traumatic stress and things of that nature. So did you get any comments or reflections from the chaplaincy about, you know, not having the training to deal with some of these issues, or feeling that they were out of their depth, did that not come up so much?
No, that came up all the time. And, you know, the challenge of how do we do this? And one of the things the chaplains always talk about is they have what they call a ministry of presence. And so they feel like one of the number one services they can provide is to help people to know that they're not alone, that they are facing these difficult situations, that they have these challenging experiences, and that there's somebody in the military that understands that they need to be human sometimes rather than just automatons or tools of a military institution, and they provide that. One chaplain said to me that place of sanctuary where people can just come and be human, where they can just come and talk, they can let their guard down, they don't have to worry about their superior hearing that they might be stressed out or might be stressing out. They don't have to worry about their peers looking at them saying, you can't handle it, you're a weakling. But they're the chaplain, because they're outside of the chain of command and they're not required to report on every conversation that they have the way that a social worker would be, they can create that safe space for people. And they acknowledged that frequently people were coming to them because they had stresses in their lives. And they might not be exclusively linked to their military or operational role. It can also be things like, you know, I've been put on a rotation, this is my third one, and my family is really struggling with it, and my marriage is in trouble, and so personal issues related to their role, or any number of different challenges. I find myself drinking too much because I don't want to think about the things that I saw, and so looking for support for those kinds of challenges. But any kinds of stresses in a person's life often were brought to the chaplain's door first, because it was a safer place to take it than to, say, a social worker or a medical worker or any of those kinds of things.
There's been a lot of debate in the United States with respect to how the veterans' issues and how veterans are treated when they return. As far as I can tell, we haven't had that same conversation in Canada. Do you see some of the same challenges, or what's kind of unique about the Canadian situation in that
I
sense?
Think that there are certain people and certain groups that are very concerned about and committed to supporting veterans. I think Romeo Dallaire has been an excellent advocate in that context, but I really feel that in Canada we are sweeping that issue under the rug, and that we have not yet seen the fallout from our most recent conflicts. I feel that, you know, it used to be, at the very least, these old veterans could hang out at the Legion and at least find a small space where they could be among people that understood them to some degree. But even that, I think, is going by the wayside. I don't think that there is enough of a cultural context of support for people who have seen and done the kinds of things that these young men and women have done and seen. And you know, whether it's in Afghanistan or whether it's in Haiti or whether it's in Malaysia, wherever it is that they've been, whatever it is that they've been doing, they've seen some pretty nasty stuff a lot of times, and they have been through some tremendous mental anguish. And I don't think as a society that we have done really anything to help them to be reintegrated or to be recognized for that kind of a sacrifice. And it's a huge sacrifice, but, you know, I don't think we like to talk in that language. I think people in Canada, and maybe other parts of the world too, but I think in Canada we are so afraid of being identified as militaristic. We don't want to be militaristic, so I think that's where that national myth of being peacekeepers comes from. We want to be the good guys. But I think at the same time, we don't recognize that if we want to be the good guys and we want to put our military personnel into places that help and that serve and that protect, that those people are very likely to come out injured in the process, you know, damaged and burdened. And then so what is our responsibility as a society subsequent to that? What's our role? How do we then express our gratitude and our appreciation for upholding that aspect of our Canadian identity? I don't think we've had that conversation, and I think it is going to need to be had, because I think there are a lot of people that are suffering because of what they've done.
Suffering privately.
I really don't think there's a really good support network yet for them to either to express their experiences or to engage with others or to be honored or recognized or supported by the civilian population. I don't know, and I don't suggest that I know what that would look like, because I don't think it would be the same as what we've done in the past. Like, I don't think Remembrance Day is going to work for those people. I think it's a whole new world. But what that looks like, I don't know. But I just think that we have failed in that respect as a society. We have not put we've never taken the second step following the idea that, well, we want to be more than just a combat force. We want to be a humanistic kind of force. Well, then we have to provide for the humans that are involved in it. And I'm not sure that we've done that yet.
Right. But I mean, in terms of the comparison with the U.S., they don't have the same kind of bureaucratic difficulties in getting, you know, money and healthcare and those kinds of situations, I imagine.
I think it's dependent on the individual. I've heard different stories. Again, this is not an area that I know well, so I wouldn't, I can't give you statistics or numbers specifically on this, but I've heard a number of stories of people who, especially with PTSD, because it's sometimes invisible until it explodes, right? So it's not like you come back and you say, well, I need a prosthetic leg. It's that you come back and you have difficulty being in crowds. You know, and then that goes downhill. That, well, now I can't drive, and now I can't go into large areas where there's going to be noise and activities that are going to set me off. And eventually, you know, those people end up that maybe they can't work, or maybe that they have no quality of life. And I think that this PTSD issue and stress-related injuries, that's the area that. That's the pot that's simmering right now and will eventually bubble over and has bubbled over. There are stories of individuals who have really been destroyed by what they've seen abroad. And I described several of those in the book, but people who have ended up just being abandoned essentially by the military system and not ever received the support that they needed. And, you know, some of them end in suicide, and some of them end in murder, and some of them end in, you know, horrible things because these people simply, they can't cope, and then they don't cope, and then a crisis happens.
Yeah. It's not really a national conversation that
no,
we're having.
No, not at all. Not yet.
From the publication of your book, what has been the reaction from the military itself? Have they incorporated any of the findings, or has there been a backlash of any kind?
There's been different reactions. I think there was a lot of appreciation, a lot of use of the book by the chaplains themselves, and it has been adopted in different leadership courses at RMC, Royal Military College. So there's certainly a lot of interest. Particularly, I think, again, there's a resistance outside of the chaplaincy. There's a resistance to taking any particular focus on religion, but there is an interest in being what they call culturally competent. So understanding the different groups within the ranks. So there's interest there. I think there will be. It will be interesting to see how things develop as we increase the diversity. Right now, the diversity in the forces is really still it's minimal. You know, there are a handful of people that are just okay with being very visible minorities. And then there are many people that think, well, why would I go there? Because I don't see anybody else that looks like me there. And that's not a comfortable place for me to be. So I think as, years pass and we see a much more significant integration within the military, that the issues that I've outlined and identified will become far more poignant, and there will be more attention being paid at that time. But right now, I think it's almost barely on their radar that they need to be too concerned with this. They deal with the issues on a case-by-case basis, so, you know, an individual comes to, say, their chaplain or their sergeant and says, I follow this tradition, I need these meals, I need this accommodation, and they make it happen. But, you know, what happens when you have a whole unit that requires certain accommodation? How do you integrate them with other groups? What questions are being asked? What does that look like? So they haven't got to that place yet. So I think that will be... that's yet to be seen as we move forward in our increasingly multicultural context here in Canada. That will be a very interesting development to watch.
Right. That's kind of the next obvious step in the multicultural process. what are you working on next in terms of your research projects? And is there another book in the works somewhere?
Actually, I have an edited volume coming out this November, and it's on some of the work that I've been doing since the Religion in the Ranks book has been tied to international development and the engagement of students in higher education, actually, going in and having experiences in the developing world. So, you know, what that looks like, how it's enacted, how that fits with a neoliberal approach to higher education in Canada, questions about neocolonialism and white privilege and all that kind of stuff. And so the book that is coming out now is called The World is My Classroom. It's a co-edited volume with Dr. Michelle Desjardins at Wilfrid Laurier, and it is a collaborative piece with people from across the country, really, and it looks at issues in internationalizing Canadian higher education. And it talks about the link, I would say, between the book Religion in the Ranks and this one is that, again, it's looking at a Canadian institution and the role of values and the way that those values either align with or conflict with notions of Canadian identity and Canadian projects, especially in the international sphere. So we are continuing that work with other studies, but that's been my most recent project. And then, you know, odds and ends, papers here and there.
Well, great. The book again is Religion in the Ranks, Belief and Religious Experience in the Canadian Forces, published by University of Toronto Press in 2011. And thanks again for joining us, Joanne.
Thanks so much, Amar.